This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Abby Oma-Dunby is a vice president, and he's also an economist for PNC Financial Services. And we talk with him once a month about news of the economy here in Northwest Indiana, in Indiana, and the Midwest and the country. And Abby, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me again, Chris.
Well, if you will, first tell us with the stimulus packages that have been passed and the supply dislocations that apparently we're all facing these days, should we be concerned about inflation through the rest of 2021?
Right. So prices have been increasing in recent months. The latest inflation reading last week showed that inflation overshot consensus expectations, both on the month-over-month basis and also on a year-over-year basis. But I'm not worried about the high inflation numbers because, there are a few factors at play here. First, we're comparing with 2020 when there was no economic activity and there was no demand. You know, so that's why we're seeing the year-over-year increase in prices.
Mm-hmm.
Also, another factor at play here is the supply chain dislocations. The producers are not able to increase capacity fast enough to meet the pent-up demand.
Yeah.
I do expect the inflation numbers to moderate, very soon. And I think as soon as production increases, that's going to moderate prices.
I see that we've had a surge in prices in lumber in particular, and there are a lot of other commodities like steel and copper that have jumped in price. And we hear lately, too, about the fact that it costs so much more to get a house built if you can get the property available to be able to build a house. And does this mean that we happen to be in a bubble, or is this something that we know will finally work its way out?
That's a great point, Chris. Commodities have exploded in the past year. So steel, copper, iron ore, lumber, they've all seen just massive price increases in the past year. I think it's very likely that there is some speculative activity in the metals industry, but I do also feel that the same things are at play here. So inventories are low, in industrial production is still below the pre-pandemic level, capacity utilization is still below the pre-pandemic level, but as global inventories increase and production increases, we're going to see more moderate price growth in base metals and also in lumber in the rest of 2021.
That's good to hear. What's the Fed's outlook on the U.S. economy right now from the last time you've checked here? Are we likely to have some increase in interest rates anytime soon if the recovery is continuing?
Right. So the high inflation numbers have caught the Fed's attention, but the Fed is not even thinking about increasing interest rates at this point. The Fed wants to wait till there's a broad-based and inclusive recovery. That's a recovery that includes groups that are usually more vulnerable during downturns. So, minorities, women, African Americans, the Latinx community, and so on. So the Fed is, waiting till, the recovery is very strong and broad-based, and it's affecting, all groups. In our forecast, we're expecting the Fed to adjust its quantitative easing program next year, and we don't expect the Fed to increase interest rates till 2023.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look now at what PNC Financial Services is looking at for the outlook for not only the U.S. but the Northwest Indiana and the Hoosier economies. How do things look?
Right. So, regionally speaking, the Northwest Indiana economy has made significant progress since last year. Take Elkhart, for example. The labor market has improved. Thanks to the strong demand for RVs, it's the RV capital of the world. The unemployment rate is back at the pre-pandemic level. So the goods producing sector has recovered, but the service providing sector is still below the pandemic level.
Mm-hmm.
So I do expect that the service providing sector is going to improve in the second half, and the economy is going to make strong progress over the course of the year.
Do we hear anything new about the major impact that small businesses around the country are facing these days? I know that some of the organizations like the NFIB are very pleased that some of the changes are going to happen from the White House and from Capitol Hill, and that's going to ease things for their members. Do you see on the whole that small businesses are going to start recovering from the pandemic as they are trying to do right now?
I do. I do see it. So I think one of the one of the reasons why we've the recovery, we've made so much progress from an economic standpoint has been because of the substantial fiscal stimulus, which included the Paycheck Protection Program, which was targeted at small and mid-sized businesses. So I think many small and mid-sized businesses have benefited from this. Many small and mid-sized businesses are still not at at pre-pandemic level of activity, but as the labor market improves and as the overall general economy improves, small and mid-sized businesses are going to make progress.
Abby Omadundi is a vice president, and he's also economist for PNC Financial Services. We get to talk with him once a month about economic news. And as always, thanks for joining us this month, and we'll talk to you again next month.
Sure. Thanks so much, Chris.
Tourism people and people who are encouraging folks to move and to live and work in Indiana like to mention the fact that Indiana is an affordable place to live. But there are some questions that need to be asked by many as to for whom is it affordable and compared to what? Well, there's an organization called the National Low Income Housing Coalition, along with the Indiana-based Prosperity Indiana, have come out with a report recently, and they found that there's a shortage of nearly 7 million affordable and available rental homes for extremely low-income renter households in the country. Let's find out more about the report and how Indiana fares in it. We have with us the policy director of Prosperity Indiana, Andrew Bradley, with us from his office in Indianapolis. And Andrew, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Will you fill us in on, first off, how the data was put together and what discovered how Indiana fares as far as having the affordable housing available that these organizations are touting is out there? What affordable housing really is available for Hoosier families?
Sure. Well, this report called The Gap looks at the number of affordable and available housing units, especially for renter families, throughout the country using available HUD data, census data, and basically just looking at, like, how does that translate to where people can actually live based on the income that they have. And so something that I found really striking looking at this data for Indiana is that, as you mentioned, Indiana prides itself on this reputation of being an affordable place to live. And sometimes that's used, frankly, by our policymakers as kind of a crutch not to do anything about issues like housing or income. But when it comes to affordable housing, Indiana actually has the second least number of affordable and available housing units per 100 renter families, and actually is also the second highest cost burden, meaning that people spend the most of their income on housing. So people are putting more of their dollars towards housing than most places in the Midwest. And at the same time, there are fewer units to go around. And actually for Northwest Indiana, that is even, those disparities are even wider than statewide.
Mm-hmm. In the report that came out, I was noticing some of the data, and they mentioned that you're talking about the available housing per 100, and there's 37 homes, rental homes for every 100 ELI renter households. That's not very much. What community or state, for that matter, fared about the same or was even less available?
So, you're right. Statewide, there are only 37 units, or imagine like apartments, available per 100 low-income renters. Now, for Northwest Indiana, it's even lower. It's only 32 affordable and available rental units per 100. Even just next door looking, I took a look at the Chicago metro area. They're at 34. So it's not just a matter of being part of this larger Chicagoland area region. It really does, it's a combination of having lower incomes and less attention on making sure that people have an affordable place to live.
We take a look at the data, of course, that most people take a look at, and we're looking at particularly before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, that there were a lot of problems for people to be able to afford to find affordable housing to begin with. What were some of the areas that they, in turn, were running into as their obstacles to be able to find affordable housing?
Well, that's exactly right. Indiana had a pre-existing condition when it comes to affordable housing and housing security. And one aspect of that, it does come down to eviction problems. Indiana has been shown to have one of the highest rates and numbers of evictions in the country. And this is ranked by another report by Eviction Lab out of Princeton University. And they have recently been showing real-time information during the COVID pandemic and are finding that in some counties in Indiana, including Lake County, evictions are actually up above pre-pandemic averages despite the CDC eviction moratorium that's happening. So I think what we see coming out of that is that it is this combination of, you know, there's kind of a lack of really good, secure places where people are able to afford, where they can live, to have good, high-quality standards. And then also you have this pandemic on top and a lack of renter protection, and people are just kind of falling through the cracks.
Let's now talk about the pandemic. Since the pandemic hit more than a year ago, and you, of course, the data you probably have just covers the start of the pandemic, I'm sure, but we can kind of look ahead to the rest of the year and into 2021. What kind of problems have folks that can't afford the housing the most are facing now?
Well, you know, I do want to point out that, you know, housing is healthcare. In order, especially, and this has become very clear during this pandemic, that if people don't have a secure, stable place to live, then they're not able to do those things that we've all been talking about for the past year in terms of socially distance and make sure that you keep yourself clean and you're able to have the option to work from home or have children studying from home and keeping up with their peers. And when you have those eviction rates and you have that lack of affordable housing like Indiana does compared to its neighbors, it's no surprise that those associated public health and economic issues are going to be compounded. Something that we've seen from the last recession is that housing instability can be a lagging indicator because people, another saying goes that people, that rent eats first, that people will pay rent first and then sometimes skimp on other bases. So you may have people who have missed paychecks, maybe still are missing some paychecks or some shifts at work, and they're paying rent as much as they can. They're drawing down on savings. Maybe they're borrowing from friends and families. But when all those other lifelines run out, that's when evictions and foreclosures, too, can become a problem, sometimes months after the onset of other economic indicators.
Now, what does Prosperity Indiana and the LNIHC have to say about ways to resolve some of these issues?
Well, you know, this really is it's something that needs to be dealt with at the local, state, and federal level, right? The state General Assembly just wrapped up, and unfortunately there wasn't a lot done for housing stability. So we're really looking and focusing at what can be done at the federal level right now. And as you mentioned, Prosperity Indiana and our partners, our national partners at the National Low Income Housing Coalition, are really trying to make sure that our Indiana congressional delegation is aware of some of these options that are on the table. And when it comes to increasing and preserving the supply of affordable renting homes, we're asking that Congress increase the Housing Trust Fund to be able to build and preserve homes that are affordable to people at the lowest income. We want to make sure that we rehabilitate the public housing supply that we already have so that those don't deteriorate and become unavailable. And then finally, we're also asking Congress to use federal transportation investments to require inclusive zoning and land use reforms to reverse residential segregation and increase that supply of affordable homes.
Do you think that there's any possibility that some of the stimulus money that has come about and now the discussion of what can be used in federal funds for the infrastructure could be set aside and help out in this respect?
Yes, there's actually some really good news, both out of the most recent stimulus package that was passed. That had some funds set aside specifically for rental assistance. So that could hopefully stop some of the bleeding and some of the evictions. And I know that there are 7 different emergency rental assistance programs throughout the state, including one specifically for Lake County and one run by IHCDA for the rest of the state, that we're encouraging folks to call in. If you've missed income, make sure you apply so that we want to keep people stably housed. And then in this new infrastructure package that's being discussed, there's some provisions, including some from our current Senator Todd Young, that have been brought up in the past. That we're hoping will be considered in this new package that definitely get at affordable housing and also increasing that supply of affordable housing.
Andrew,
there is reason to be optimistic.
Well, Andrew, thank you for spending time going over the report and the data that's come out of it. And let's hope that our congressional delegation learns more and does some more to help solve the issue, or at least work towards solving the issue of affordable housing. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Bradley is the Policy Director of Prosperity Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
There's some people out there that don't want the help. They don't want it. And I've seen people who don't take the help, and then they end up in the same predicament that they were in. They don't have the same opportunities because they didn't take the opportunities that were given to them. But there are people out there that really need help, and there are people out there that don't want to be on the system forever, that don't want welfare, that don't take advantage of it. They're taking stepping stones to get where they need to get, and for that period of time, they have to let their pride go and get the help that they need. Housing Opportunities helps me by providing a roof. We go over goals. They help you find steps to finding a job. They give you resources to help you go to school. They introduce you to other nonprofit organizations that help you with other things. They helped my son with his speech therapy. They referred me to somebody. They referred me to First Steps. They referred me to Early Head Start, the Family Youth Service Bureau. They paid for my car insurance for the first 6 months when I first got my car. I graduated from them, I guess you can say now. But they were truly amazing, every single one of them that I had. Geminis Head Start, a nonprofit organization. My son went there for 2 years, and I loved the teachers that he had. One time I didn't have enough money to pay for my son's pictures. The teachers put in the money to buy his pictures. I mean, then you have food stamps and welfare that helps provide food, medical coverage. That helps a lot, too. My case manager, Cindy, is an incredible role model. She comes out to the apartment, she talks to us, goes over the goals. She's taught me how to be a mom. She's amazing. She is more than just a case manager to me. Right now, things are pretty good. I do watch children out of my house. Yes, it's not a lot of money, but I'm able to pay my bills. I'm able to buy my son what he needs, keep a roof over our head. I was looking for another job, and I'm going to start looking for another job again as soon as I have a reliable car. It's still hard, you still struggle, especially when your car is constantly breaking down. You don't have enough money to pay for everything and fix your car. So the bills have to come first and then the car. But I'm managing. We eat, we have a roof, he has clothes. I think people need to step outside of the box and look around for a minute and see that there are people out there that are really struggling and that are not taking advantage of the system and that really, really do need help. I think that it's just the way you look at it. If you've never been in that situation, then it's hard for people to understand what it's like. I think sometimes you have to step back and take yourself out of your situation and put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu.
Hoosiers who are interested in seeing more women elected to public office have an opportunity to find out more in a very interesting training session. It's going to happen virtually. It's called Ready to Run Indiana, and it'll take place on May 22nd. And to tell us more about it, we have the executive director of a group called Women, the Number 4, Change. Rima Shahid is with us. And Rima, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you. Good morning. Glad to be here with you.
Will you give us first just a brief idea of what the Ready to Run Indiana organizations, which is part of, I guess, a national programming network, is all about?
Yeah. Ready to Run is actually a part of Ready to Run National, which is out of Rutgers University. It is an all-encompassing nonpartisan initiative geared to encouraging and training women interested in seeking office, as well as those that are just wanting to learn more about the process or maybe working on a campaign. And the overall goal is to help increase the number of women in office, and particularly for Ready to Run Indiana, mm-hmm. we're wanting to do that here in our great Hoosier State.
Well, I know we've had some gubernatorial candidates who have shown interest in being governor that are women. And there's some other people, of course. So we have a number of women who are in Congress. We have women that are involved in state government, but probably could add more to the list, beef up the ranks, so to speak, add more women to the ranks of public office that you as an organization are facing.
Absolutely. So last year in 2020, we commemorated the 19th Amendment, which gave some women the right to vote. But if we take a step back and think about the fact that here in Indiana, so it's been 100 years since the 19th Amendment passed, but here in Indiana, we've never had a woman governor, and we've never had federally women senators. We've only sent a handful of women to the United States Congress. And in terms of the Indiana State House, we rank well below the national average of 24.2% of state legislatures are made up of women. Mm-hmm. Well, here in Indiana, we're about 21% if you look at some of the data and surveys. And what we know is that when women are in positions of elected officials, they work together collaboratively to get the job done.
What are some of the topics that you hope to be able to bring up with this virtual event happening on May 22nd?
Time and time again, what I hear out in the community is, you know, if you're interested, run for school board. But the question is, how do I run for school board? Do I need money? Do I need a communications team? And what does the job entail? What are my responsibilities? So we're hoping to demystify and answer some of those questions around campaign finance, around communications, around how to talk with others, debate, things like that. That's what we're really hoping to get from. Because, again, when women run and when women win, the community at large does better.
Okay. Let's break down some of these specific topics I know that you're going to bring up in the event coming up. Let's talk first about fundraising. What are things that should be brought up that women may have had experience, certainly if their husbands have been involved in public office, that they may not know, that they should know?
Yeah, absolutely. So something that women actually face when they're running is a lot of scrutiny. People are looking at these candidates under a fine microscope where they're not looking at men like that. And so folks wonder, well, will I be able to fundraise? And you'll be surprised when people throw their hat in the ring, you'll have neighbors and others that support you. But again, it's about taking that first step and understanding what do you need in your pocketbook or in your tools to be able to take that first step.
And I would imagine, too, that volunteers and getting people to help volunteer for your particular campaign is very important.
Exactly. And again, we have, you know, being members of the community, we are volunteers ourselves, we help others. And so it's being able to ask for help and identifying, this is what I need from you. And we will find more often than not, people will step up and support those candidates. But it's about just empowering people to make sure that they know how to make those asks and identify those so that others can help them.
Now, the organization Ready to Run Indiana is set up, as you mentioned earlier at the start of our conversation, is a bipartisan effort. And so politics, unfortunately, do have to be involved. How does one be able to navigate party politics? And obviously, that's going to be a topic you'll talk about, right?
Yes, absolutely. But here, I think what people have to remember is that the bipartisan or the lack of bipartisan efforts are mostly in Washington, D.C. Here in Indiana, in our Indiana State House, we see folks working across the aisle to pass meaningful legislation on behalf of Hoosiers. The issues that Women for Change follows, for example, majority, if not all of those, have been authored and co-authored by women from both sides of the aisle. It's refreshing if you ever have an opportunity to walk into the State House. You will see people from Democrats and Republicans just standing together working to ensure that they are passing these legislation that Hoosiers really need. And right now what we know is that COVID-19 has really hit women the hardest in terms of jobs lost, trying to take care of children while virtual learning, and they are the majority of our frontline workers. But we need to pass legislation that supports those same very women. And that's, again, why we need more women in office.
it's a matter of women being involved in politics or just in any kind of elected public office. You have family members that certainly want to be supportive, but how do you work with them to get them ready for what they may face as you go through the campaign?
Right, and that's another conversation that we're going to be having, is what do you need to tell your family? Because the unfortunate truth is that our candidates do need to have a pretty thick skin. And so what can a family member expect? How long are the hours? What does canvassing look like? What is that door-to-door? Are they going to be asked to make phone calls? How do they respond to positivity or negativity regarding their family member that's a candidate? And I think that's important that family members and friends have a really clear understanding of what that looks like as a candidate and hits the campaign trail.
Yeah. Rima, will you fill us in on some of the other participants in the Ready to Run Indiana event that is coming up virtually on May 22nd?
We have a number of people that are signed up, but what I'd really like to talk about is our previous Ready to Run events.
Uh-huh.
Our first Ready to Run, we had 140 people that came to that event, 70 of which either ran for office themselves or started working for a campaign. The next year, we had around 50 to 60 participants, and at least a third of those either ran for office or they were working on a campaign. So this is a really great model. We find people getting fired up, involved, and it can be anywhere from your local municipal level all the way up to state representatives that have been candidates that have attended Ready to Run in the past.
And will you fill us in, please, on how people may want to participate in this virtual event coming up on May 22nd, Ready to Run Indiana?
Yes, absolutely. So you can visit our website. It's www.womenthenumber4changeindiana.org. So you can sign up and attend the event. If you need a scholarship, please feel free to email us at welcome@womenforchangeindiana.org. We never think that cost should be a barrier. Cost should never be a barrier to attend and get involved civically and politically. So we do offer free scholarships to anyone that is interested.
Rima Shahid is the executive director of Women for Change Indiana, and the organization is working to set up a virtual event that begins on May 22nd at 9 a.m. and runs through the day on that date. And find out more by going online. Ready to Run Indiana, part of the network that has been founded to help recruit and train women to become more involved in politics. Rima, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
As more and more Americans are vaccinated for COVID-19, some states are beginning to lift restrictions on gatherings. But for some people, the thought of going back to a pre-pandemic lifestyle is cause for anxiety. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson reports.
Miranda Tetzloff is a 25-year-old who has two pit bull mixes named Bub and Goose. She takes them on long walks for exercise, but she recently caught herself backing out of a hike because she was afraid of seeing other people on the trail.
Oh, it's nice outside. We've been in a pandemic and everyone's been cooped up in their homes. Oh, that means everyone's going to probably also be at the park. And so that just kind of terrifies me.
Tetzloff, a childcare worker, lives in a suburb of Indianapolis. There are still about 1,000 new COVID cases a day in the state, but the governor recently lifted the statewide mask mandate and ended restrictions on businesses. Daily life is slowly starting to resemble pre-pandemic times, and Tetzloff says that worries her.
I don't know what the next person's doing with their life. I don't know if they just got off a plane. I don't know, you know, what they're doing and how they're keeping themselves safe.
Tetzloff has been vaccinated, but is still overwhelmed when she notices people not wearing a mask or not taking social distancing as seriously as before.
It's just anxiety. I feel like that's like what I feel when I think about having to go to the park or like see other people.
Kevin Rand says feeling anxious about going back to pre-COVID activities is normal. He's a psychology professor at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis.
So given that many of us have been sort of, you know, staying at home or not doing the things we typically do for the last year, as we start to reengage in those activities, they're going to seem new and a little bit anxiety provoking.
He says these feelings are similar to the anxiety felt before the first day of school and are likely to pass soon.
Because we're going back to something we've done before, that predicts it'll be a pretty quick recovery to feeling normal again.
Rand says some people might experience anxiety for longer. If feelings extend for a few weeks, he recommends seeking professional help. And he says people will have legitimate concerns about their health.
There is still a pandemic going on. So even though, you know, we're making good progress with vaccinations and things like that, there is a health stressor out there.
That's the sort of thing that concerns Misty Asbury, an office worker for a utility company in Indianapolis. She's worked from home since the pandemic started and is hesitant to go back to the office.
I'm very concerned about going back into a workplace and working just because it is an office where you're in cubicles, so you're not enclosed in your own workspace per se. We have one break room for essentially 80 people.
Asbury worries about not being able to assess the cleanliness of the office. She says she is fully vaccinated, but is still erring on the side of caution, limiting public outings and declining family gatherings.
I think people need to do a personal risk assessment.
That's Thomas Dzinski, an epidemiologist with the Indiana University Fairbanks School of Public Health. He says it's important for people to look at what they and others are doing to reduce the chance of catching the virus, especially as it mutates and continues to infect people.
So it's assessing how much risk an individual has. And then I think there's also the social responsibility that we all have a certain social obligation to help each other out.
Like getting vaccinated, wearing masks, and continuing to social distance. Asbury doesn't feel comfortable quite yet in going back into the world.
I'm anxious in a happy way to be around people, but I kind of think I want it on my own terms to be able to do that.
She'll finally feel safe when COVID cases and the positivity rate fall, and when everyone is fully vaccinated. From Side Effects Public Media, I'm Darian Benson.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.